listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And hello, everybody. Welcome to the Tom Hartman Program. Obviously, I am not Tom Hartman. I am Danielle, Tom's producer. He's just running a few minutes late, and he'll be with us
very shortly. Yes.
We're also working on getting Dr. Stephanie Kelton, chair of the Department of Economics at the University of Missouri at Kansas City. She's going to be on talking modern monetary theory with Tom, something I know you've heard him talk about here. And they're going to get into that and take some of your calls and questions for Dr. Kelton. And Shano is with me.
I am.
So before we get Tom to you, we figured we'd touch on the breaking news from NBA Commissioner Adam Silver.
Just minutes ago, we were watching this in the studio.
Tom talked a lot yesterday about the comments made by Sterling, the owner of the Clippers, and racism in general, which is obviously still a big problem in our country.
Even though the Supreme Court seems to think it's all over with and done with, it's just fine. You know, everything's just great. You know, don't worry about voting rights. Don't worry about affirmative action. Everything's great. And then we have these examples out in Nevada, the example out in California, that proves quite otherwise. And the NBA is finally taking some action. You know, they actually moved a lot quicker than I expected them to. And when this first all started happening, I was a little disappointed, I've got to be honest, that the players were still playing. And, you know, I realize there are people on either side of this debate saying, you know, they're doing something, but they're not doing enough. And the players, I think, now were quite wise to wait for the NBA to act, don't you?
Absolutely. Just breaking news, NBA Commissioner Adam Silver fined Donald Sterling $2.5 million, which may not be a lot in terms of what Roger Sterling is worth, Donald Sterling. However, it is the maximum allowed by the NBA. And, you know, it shows that they are taking this very seriously, as racism certainly should be taken. This is an issue that we as a country, I think, are working very hard to banish. These are the dark days of our history, and I think many of us would like to see these days be long gone. In a press conference today, Adam Silver also banned Donald Sterling for life from any of the Clippers game, as well as many other associations with the NBA League. Do we have Dr. Kelton?
We will have her at 20 after when Tom gets here.
Sounds good.
Does that sound all right?
That sounds great.
Time differences can just be amazing. You know?
Yes.
So, you know, it's been a little bit of a frantic day, obviously. So, but she will be here with Tom, and then we'll get into modern monetary theory. And I would imagine there's going to be a ton of callers on what we're talking about right here.
Yes, absolutely. And you can certainly call and give your take. Right now, the phones are not open
because
there's
no one at them.
One person short to answer the phones.
But
in just a few minutes, you can give Tom a call and give him your thoughts on this recent announcement. I think many people are still questioning whether or not the players are going to strike.
Well,
did they come out and say anything about
players, that? I was listening to the players' response to the commissioner's sanctions against Sterling. And I don't think I've heard a stronger endorsement of what he did. Because the commissioner went to the absolute maximum what he could do under his authority. $2.5 million, that's the maximum he could find them. Banned him for life. Advised all of the teams that they should vote to strip him of his ownership. And with a 3/4 vote of those owners, they can strip him of his ownership of that team. That was the most he could do. I bet you he wished he could just say, you can't have this team anymore. But he's advised the owners to do this. One of the questions was, you know, what have the owners told you? Are they behind you on this? And he's like, everyone that I've spoken to, yes. So it's just a matter of time. Now the players said, we endorse what he did. He went as far as he could. Now we want to know the time frame for when this vote's going
to
happen.
Referring to Commissioner Silver's action.
Well, the time frame for the owners to get together to have this vote to strip him of his ownership.
And there's been a lot of discussion about how much Donald Sterling bought the team for and what he could sell the team for and how it still stands to make a killing.
There's an interesting discussion to have in there.
Right.
Because we have banks that are too big to fail. Do we have people who are so rich to punish? They're so rich you cannot punish them civilly. They have so much darn money. There is nothing you can do to them. They can say whatever they want, and the only real punishment they have is societal and turn them into pariah.
Right, but I think that does hold weight. You know, do you want to be the next guy to get into business with Donald Sterling?
Does he need to be in business ever again?
But hey, would you want to go and sign that deal after this incident?
Oh, absolutely not. No one will do business with him.
Right.
But the thing is how punishment is about retribution, but some would say vengeance, but it's also about deterrence.
Right.
If you're already a billionaire, how do you deter someone else from doing the same thing if they're still going to be a billionaire afterwards? And it's about punishment, about harming the person who harmed everyone else, harming them back, retribution.
Yeah.
And you can't harm a billionaire, at least money-wise, unless the fine was exorbitant.
Yeah.
There are people who are too rich to punish.
There certainly are. And I have to, I don't recall which caller said this to me yesterday. For anybody who doesn't know, I'm the one answering the phones that you talk to if you call in to speak with Tom. And somebody said, you know, someone needs to give Oprah Winfrey a call and tell her that there is a team for sale. One of the few people that probably has a personal take on this issue and has the money to go in and buy herself a sports team.
Right. And now there's the finger pointing. Shouldn't have you have known better?
Yeah.
You know, isn't this well known because, you know, years back he had the largest fine as a slumlord and just all kinds of different racist things he had been doing. So it was kind of well known, and people are now saying, well, NBA, how did you not know? How did you let this guy in?
Right.
Which I don't know if that's beneficial to the discussion. You know, do you say, this is what we find out, this is the evidence we have now, now let's move forward, this is what we're going to do, and we're going to do the maximum.
Right.
We're going to try to restore the NBA, restore its reputation, do right by our players, and that's all they can really do at this point, I believe.
And Adam Silver addressed those points and said that, you know, as much as the public may view the previous charges against Sterling as concrete and clear evidence of his racism, they were simply charges. And
well,
you know,
right.
We do have this system of innocent until proven guilty. And as much as sometimes we condemn someone in the court of public opinion,
right.
You know, they were acting on a business sense as, you know, he was innocent and he was not proven to have committed the charges.
Right, because he settled it. He made a payment.
Right.
So there was never an adjudication by courts. And you can get into real trouble if they were to have taken action based on without getting that judgment, because he could have said, well, you're slandering me, you're libeling me, I'm going to sue you back. So there are limits to what they could do. Now those limits are not in place anymore because they have this evidence.
Right. I mean, hindsight's always 20/20, and
course.
It's very easy to go back and condemn somebody's actions that have already occurred. But I think the more proactive view here is, how do we go forward?
Sure.
You know, how do we expose people like this and make it clear that as a society, we will speak out, we will stand up, and we will, you know, make sure that people like this aren't, that they know it's not okay.
They're not welcome.
Right.
And when we have those debates, and when you have them with your conservative friends and family members, and they discuss things like affirmative action, and they discuss things like voting rights, and they say that, you know, yes, there has been a lot of progress over the last 50 years, but not nearly enough.
Right.
And in some ways, we seem to be going backwards. When they say, well, we have a black president, it's over. Everything's fine. These are the types of things you need to bring up. You have this evidence to think this is still systemic.
Yeah.
We have one of the richest people out there who owns an NBA team who still says these things. You've got a person who's a rancher who has, you know, thousands of people with guns coming out to support him. You know, this is the evidence that it's not, that we still have work to do, all of us.
We still have a lot of work to do, but as a society, we certainly can do it. And as NBA Commissioner Adam Silver proved here, just a reminder, Tom will be back here in just a few minutes, not sure exactly when, with Dr. Stephanie Kelton. Stick around.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
What's your take on the NBA commissioner's actions? Did it go far enough? Can we go farther?
And welcome back. 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Thank you so much to Danielle and Shane for filling in for me. I was over at the TV studios and being interviewed by Larry King. And was like, I mean, the guy's such a legend, you know? And there was, and he's in Los Angeles, and I'm here in D.C., and we were having all these technical problems. The video was working fine, but we couldn't hear each other. And they ended up having to connect us with a telephone line. So we're talking on the telephone on the video. You've seen that done here, right? And, but it took like 25 minutes. And so I got here, you know, rushing like crazy and running. And anyway, I'm here. And on the way over in the car, on the way over from the TV studio here to the radio studio, I opened my Tom Hartman app on my phone, on my iPhone, and listened to Shane and Danielle fill in for me. And you guys did a great job. And, you know, not just great radio voices. I mean, great content. Great job. And I think that one of the questions that you raised is a really important question. In particular, Shane, you raised this question, and it was, if somebody's a billionaire and you want to slap their wrist, you want to punish them for doing wrong, and your only means to do it is financial, do you really have the means to punish them? I would say no. And it's the same thing. I mean, this is Jamie Dimon and J.P. Morgan Chase. He's got more money than God, and so does his bank. And we find out that his bank, and, you know, presumably he's the head of the bank, so he's fully responsible for this, that these guys have been not just ripping people off, not just conspiring to rip people off, but literally destroying people's lives. I mean, the crimes that have been committed, and I'm calling them crimes because they're actually, these guys have pled guilty to these things. The crimes that have been committed by the Wall Street banksters have led literally to suicides, homicides, homelessness, death by diseases that should have been otherwise caught, but people, you know, the economy fell apart, they lost their job, they lost their health insurance, and they never did anything about that lump in their breast, and oh my God. I mean, these guys are guilty of murder. And we can't do anything about it. We hit them with a $600 million fine, and a $30 million fine, a $1 billion fine, $16 billion or some mind-boggling amount of money that one of the big banks in New York just got hit with. Billions, tens of billions of dollars. They don't care. So how do you respond to somebody like Donald Silver? That's his name. Sterling. Sterling Silver, of course. How do you respond to somebody like Donald Sterling or Jamie Dimon when they, now Sterling has not committed a crime, right? I mean, you know, his crime is a political one. His crime is a social one. He, and I think frankly, you know, they're going to get together and force him to sell the team. And gee, the poor guy, he's going to make a $900 million profit. Life is tough. I frankly don't so much see or understand, you know, how you punish him other than just banish him. You know, you publicly shame him. What he has done is he's committed a crime against the public, and so the public shames him. I mean, that's the appropriate response, it seems. Get him out of the league, make him a pariah. You know, the guy's 80 years old, and the word on the street is that he was asking his girlfriend to record these things because he couldn't remember what he was talking about from day to day. It sounds like he's losing it, like he has dementia. So whatever, you know, he said a shameful thing. You shame him. But a much larger question that is not being discussed in our media, that this should be raising, just like, you know, the tornadoes and earthquakes and hurricanes killing all these people in the Midwest, now heading toward the East Coast here. And while you got a drought and 100 degree plus weather, a friend of mine, Lila Connors, who's producing the, you know, our series on global climate change, you can see over at lasthours.org. She called me this morning. She said, greetings from Los Angeles, where we're having a climate change event. I was like, what are you talking about? She says, it's over 100 degrees. It's going to be this way for days. And I'm like, well, out here, the weather's killing people. And nobody will come out and say, the fact of the matter is that the atmosphere has 5% more moisture than it did when Ronald Reagan came into the White House. And the temperature is a degree warmer, 8/10 of a degree. Surprise! People are dying. People are dying. And what do the Koch brothers want to do? What does ALEC want to do, the American Legislative Exchange Council? They want to tax people who put solar collectors in their house. Here you have billionaires who are shameless and should not, you know, this is why I think that it's so important that we roll back Citizens United and allow Congress to pass reasonable legislation that will limit money in politics. I mean, it's just nuts what's going on. And if you can limit money in politics, then you can limit the power of the big banks to intimidate politicians. You eliminate the power of the big banks to intimidate politicians. And guess what? The politicians will start breaking up the banks. I mean, the estate tax and the income tax came along in 1912 and 1913, if my recollection is correct. And they came along because in 1907, Teddy Roosevelt got passed the Tillman Act, which said that you go to prison if you give money if you are a corporation or representing the interests of a corporation. If you have any corporate interest in this at all and you give money to the campaign or in any way support a candidate for federal office, that's the Tillman Act, 1907. So they got money out of politics, and then they were able to pass all of these progressive reforms, including the ability of women to serve in or to vote, and also to serve in political office, the right of numerous states to amend the Constitution by ballot process, the direct election of the United States Senate, the United States Senator. I mean, all this stuff came about because in 1907 they got money out of politics. We need to do it again.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And then at the bottom of the hour, coming back, as earlier advertised, Dr. Stephanie Kelton is going to be with us talking about modern monetary theory. I'm looking forward to it. Welcome back. 28 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you live from Washington, D.C. And Dr. Stephanie Kelton is with us. Again, she, and welcome very much back. She is the chair of the Department of Economics at the University of Missouri at Kansas City, creator and editor of the New Economic Perspectives blog, neweconomicperspectives.org, and Twitter is at Stephanie, E-P-H-A-N-I-E, Kelton, K-E-L-T-O-N. Dr. Kelton, welcome back to the program.
Thank you for having me. Good to be back.
It is great having you with us. I'm so sorry that I missed the first few minutes. I was on the other side of town in a TV studio doing an interview with Larry King, and we were having all kinds of technical problems, and it just became wild. And so, anyhow, but thank you for showing it back up with us.
You're welcome.
So let's start out with, you know, it's been a while since we've talked about modern monetary theory, and one of the things that really piqued my interest was Randy Ray the other day talking about MMT actually does policy. You can draw, you know, you can make policy conclusions out of MMT. So if we could start at the beginning, how does an economy work? And what does that tell us about our current economic policies to the extent that they exist in the, you know, outside of the vacuum of politics or pretending that they do, and what we should be doing?
Well, how does the economy work? I guess the very simplest way, and the way that I often say it when I travel and give talks to audiences that usually don't have much of an interest in economics, is just to say it as simply as possible, which is to say an economy like ours, a capitalist economy, runs on sales. And then I just simply go from there. So if you have an economy that runs on sales, then what you're saying is we've got a lot of businesses in the economy that hire workers and pay them wages and salaries. And with that income, workers go out and buy back some of the goods and services that are produced by firms both here in the U.S. and elsewhere. Some of the income that they earn goes to savings. Some of the income that they earn is taxed away from them. And so the economy works when there is enough demand for the goods and services that firms are producing and trying to sell at a profit, because it's capitalism, to keep us close to full employment. And when the spending power is not there and the demand is not there, well, then businesses get pretty disappointed. Their inventories start building up, sends a pretty clear signal to them that they've overproduced, and it gives them an incentive to lay off workers and scale back production. So it's this constant attempt to try to scale the production in the economy to satisfy largely consumer demand.
Wow. So it's, I mean, this is, in a way, Adam Smith, Wealth of Nations, 1776, David Ricardo, 1809. You know, it's kind of basic econ 101. How did we get from understanding that economies are driven by demand to this weird idea in the 1980s that somehow economies were actually driven by supply? And if we simply made sure that there was lots and lots of billionaires and lots of money at the top, and maybe lots and lots of goods in the stores, and the one example, of course, is always, well, Steve Jobs invented the iPhone, and suddenly there was demand for it. How did we get to this weird demand side notion?
Well, Keynes sort of fell out of favor. You know, we go through transitions in economics, and different schools of thought sort of take turns leading the academy and dominating policymaking. And so for a period of time, really in the 70s and leading up into the 1980s with Thatcher and Reagan and the supply side revolution and so forth, you got a real paradigm shift in economics where people started to think more in terms of incentives. The unemployed were unemployed because they lacked the proper incentives to go out and search for work. They were by and large lazy and shiftless. And so what you had to do was, you know, remove the so-called disincentives to work. You had to take away minimum wages or remove the social safety net, or at least substantially reduce the social safety net, so that, you know, this is where the idea of a hammock comes from.
Right.
And that businesses, what they need most is not customers with money to spend, but in fact big tax cuts, because, you know, if you deregulate businesses and provide them with lots of tax incentives, then somehow this is going to cause them to go out and spend on new machines, build new factories, and hire workers. And it's the trickle-down story that you described.
It's a fantasy, though. I mean, it's never happened in the history of the world, has it?
No, it is a fantasy, and it's bad. It's bad economics, and on the face of it, most people would understand that, you know, if you know a small business owner, you know that it's true that small business owners will tell you that they feel like their taxes are too high and they feel like regulations are burdensome and so forth. But at the end of the day, if there's a line of customers waiting to get in and a line of orders for the goods and services that they produce, they don't lay off the staff, right? They add to demand. So it's really consumer demand that drives things. And it's a convenient excuse for businesses to say, well, the reason I'm not hiring right now is because the regulations are so onerous. So the reason I'm holding back right now, adding to my workforce, is because I need some additional tax incentives. And then businesses just simply say, well, okay, you know, we can do that. And so we give them, you know, all kinds of incentives. And we've seen this over the course of the last 5 years, trying to deal with the consequences of the Great Recession, right? 100% acceleration of depreciation. Let businesses invest in new machines and depreciate them all in year one. Cut taxes, deregulate, you know, all the sorts of things that they say they were looking for. And we still don't have the kind of robust demand for labor that we should have to get us back anywhere close to full employment. So they're getting everything they want, but they're not getting what they need most, which is lots of consumers with incomes that are high enough to sustain demand, to have us going back into the stores and buying the stuff that they produce.
At what point do the people, the titans of industry, at what point do the lobbyists for the Chamber of Commerce, the businesses of America realize that this is what George Herbert Walker Bush called voodoo economics, and that we've been doing it for 33 years and it still isn't working, and start demanding a return to rational economic policies, including an increase in the minimum wage, for example, extending unemployment insurance, possibly making the government the employer of last resort. I'd love to get your thoughts on that and also on the budget deficit and debt. At what point do they say, you know, Dr. Kelton's right, we actually need customers, and here's how we get customers?
Well,
do you see it happening?
I thought I saw it happening a little bit. You remember after the fiscal cliff drama and the sequester and so forth, and one of the things that happened is that payroll taxes increased. So, you know, we had that little reduction in the withholding from workers' paychecks, the FICA line on your paycheck. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that we got by way of stimulus was a 2% cut in the payroll tax. And so everybody who's working for a living and paying into Social Security for a period of a little over a year, maybe closer to two, saw their take-home pay increase by 2%. It was a 2% cut for the worker, not the employer, but for the worker. And many of us didn't even feel it. You know, our pay went up 2%, and it was small for those of us in a higher income category. But for those, you know, near the bottom, it was a huge difference for them. It made the difference between maybe filling a prescription and having one more meal out or one more, you know, pair of jeans for the kids or something like that. And when the payroll tax cut expired at the start of January 2013, payroll taxes went up by 2%. I didn't feel it, but a lot of people did. And by the first week of February, the executives at Walmart, managers and executives, were circulating internal memos. And I remember specifically, because they were leaked to the public, one of them said, "Where are all the customers?" And I thought, wow, they're feeling it already. You know, it's only 6 weeks, 5 weeks into this thing, and already Walmart is seeing an impact of, you know, people with less disposable income. So I don't know at what point. I'm not terribly optimistic, I guess, to be honest, but I don't know at what point how bad things have to get before businesses turn to sensible economics and away from things like, well, you know, I'm for privatizing Social Security because that's a way to get my wage costs reduced by the contribution that employers have to make, which is 6.2%. That's pretty costly for both the worker and the employer contributing to Social Security. So one of the things you do see CEOs lining up to advocate is privatization of Social Security, because if you relieve them of the obligation to contribute that 6.2%, it's effectively like reducing across the board the wage bill by 6.2%. So you get that sort of thing advocated, but not really good policy that raises the incomes of workers and puts more customers into their stores.
Yeah, that doesn't put any more customers into our stores. We have just 1 minute before we have to take a very, very brief break. I've been developing this theory that, you know, there's this theory about this battle in the Republican Party between the old-fashioned GOP and the Tea Party. What if what's really going on is that there's a battle between people who actually do business and understand business, which would be the old-fashioned GOP, and a group of basically billionaires who are who have OCD, who have hoarding syndrome, and they're just, you know, trying to get more and more and more money and are not so concerned about, you know, the economy and how all these things work, as long as they can get more and more and more. Am I out on thin ice here?
I don't think you are. I mean, I think this is and they're doing it, right? I mean, we're seeing it. They're very much accomplishing that end.
Yeah. Okay. We'll continue this conversation in just a moment. If you can hold on just a second, we'll be right back. Dr. Stephanie Kelton is with us. She's the chair of the Department of Economics at the University of Missouri at Kansas City, the creator and editor of the New Economic Perspectives blog, neweconomicperspectives.org. And you can tweet her at Stephanie, i.e., Kelton, K-E-L-T-O-N. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And you want to understand economics, go to neweconomicperspectives.org. Dr. Kelton, welcome back, and thanks for sticking with us. Just so you know where we're at and what we're doing, our commercial stations, which is about half of our listenership, just left us to go into a commercial break. Our non-commercial stations, our Pacifica stations, and our Free Speech TV viewers, which is about half our audience, are still with us. And so the commercial break is 4 minutes long. We'll talk during that. We'll hit another break just like that one. When we come back, I'll summarize in a half a minute or so whatever we talked about. And then we'll have our whole audience back for the rest of until the top of the hour. Okay.
Okay.
So your thoughts on what we can or should do about where we're at right now. How do we fix this economy that is so badly broken?
Well, I think, you know, early on in the aftermath of the crisis, the group of economists that get referred to as the sort of MMT school, we were advocating for really three things. We wanted to see a full payroll tax holiday, and we wanted it for the worker and the employer. And this was when we recognized that the downturn was likely to be much more severe than most economists and most pundits, and I think politicians, understood. And so we thought that we needed aggressive payroll tax cut to put money in the hands of people who are most likely to do two things, and both are really important. One was that, you know, we had a recession that that followed a period of tremendous leverage, that the private sector borrowed a whole lot of money and drove themselves into an extremely high debt situation, and they were going to be looking to pay down debt and deleverage. And we needed to allow that to happen. And one way to put money into the hands of people who are looking to save more and spend less and pay down debt was to go directly through the paycheck and reduce payroll taxes. So we wanted that to happen. And then for those who weren't struggling with high debt, who would take the additional income and go out and spend some or all of it, that would then provide the customers that would lead to the job creation and so forth. So we wanted the payroll tax holiday. We recognized that state and local governments were hemorrhaging. Taxes had fallen off a cliff. They were laying off public sector workers left and right, and we needed to stem the crisis. Now, we did some of that, but we recognized that it probably needed to be quite a bit bigger, distributed on a per capita basis, aid to help state and local governments shore up their own balance sheets and avoid the kinds of cuts and layoffs that we had seen. And then the third thing was really to mop up everything that was left behind, to deal with the fact that you never get and sustain full employment in a capitalist economy. Just doesn't happen. Capitalist economies are dynamic. They go through periods of boom, followed by busts, followed by booms, and so forth, and the cycle repeats. And there are always more job seekers than there are job vacancies. We'd never get close to keeping the economy at full employment. So for everyone who's ready, willing, and able to work, but not able to find employment in the economy, either in the private or public sector, we wanted a federally funded jobs program modeled on the WPA, the CCC, the National Youth Administration, which provided, these are Roosevelt programs. These are New Deal programs, right? The National Youth Administration took care of the young folks who couldn't find jobs. And so we've got unemployment rates hovering around 20% for young people. So those are the sorts of things that we wanted then and that I would still support now.
Yeah. And it all has worked in the past. It's, you know, unlike supply side economics. It's incredible. Dr. Stephanie Kelton, we will be back in 20, 30 seconds here. The chair of the Department of Economics at the University of Missouri at Kansas City, New Economic Perspectives Center. We'll be right back. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Dr. Stephanie Kelton, the chair of the Department of Economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, creator and editor of the New Economic Perspectives.org blog, is on the line with us. And Dr. Kelton, you were suggesting that we should have New Deal kind of programs, government as employer of last resort, bring back the WPA and CCC, the National Youth Program, things like that. And that we should also have a tax holiday, at least with regard to the payroll tax, so that immediately average working people, the payroll tax is only paid on the first $116,000, $117,000 worth of income, if I recall correctly.
That's right.
So working people would immediately see an increase in their net wealth, so they would become more aggressive consumers, they'd be able to pay down their debt and once again participate in the economy. If that's your policy prescription, how do you respond to the inevitable freak out that comes from that, which is, oh, my God, you're talking about adding $3 trillion to the U.S. debt?
How'd you get to $3 trillion?
I just made it up.
Oh, okay.
I'm guessing if the original Obama stimulus was $800 billion, and it was really only $500 because it was all the tax cuts, but, you know, and that took us – you know, not even a third of the way, I figured it would have to be at least three times larger than that to be successful. And that's why I pulled $3 billion out of my.
Okay. Ear. Okay. Well, you know, my colleague Randy Ray and I, we've written some pieces on this, and we could get to full employment, we estimated in a most recent piece I think we did for Truthdig, for something more like $300 billion. So we're talking about a very different number.
Wow. First,
yeah. Now, the infrastructure, job creation, direct job creation and so forth, well, that depends how you deploy those workers. Now, one of the things that I've always thought that we ought to be doing is addressing our infrastructure deficit. I mean, we have got a huge problem in this country, and we put it off. And every couple of years, the American Civil Engineers Society comes out with a report card, and they give grades, you know, like letter grades, like you get on a report card when you're a kid. And they grade our infrastructure, everything from our ports and our railways to our bridges and water treatment facilities, levees, you know, the whole gamut. And the overall grade in the most recent report card is a D+. And that actually turns out to be good news, because the one they did 2 years prior, we had a D. And so the good news is our grades are going up. The bad news is so is the price tag to address the problem. So the latest infrastructure report card says that the United States of America needs to spend an estimated $3.6 trillion just to get its infrastructure up to snuff. So we've got 24 million Americans today, right now, who want full-time work and can't find it. This is not the official number. This is the broader measure of unemployment that includes all the part-timers who are part-time for economic reasons. That is, their employers have cut their hours. They want to be full-time, but they can't get enough hours. And all the discouraged workers who simply gave up and dropped out of the labor force, but who say that they would take a job tomorrow if it were available. So you add those two groups to the, you know, official numbers that we're more familiar with being reported, and you get...
Oop. We just lost Dr. Kelton. Oh, it's trying to reconnect. Isn't that wonderful? The wonders of talking on Skype. The point that she was making earlier, I think that is a point that is so, and we haven't even gotten to taxes. But the point that she was making that I thought was so brilliant is, you know, we did this before. We did this in the 1930s. It worked. It put people back to work. We can hire people. We can have the government be the employer of last resort. And this idea that, you know, we need to do away with these, with things like long-term unemployment insurance, because it's a disincentive to work. As Paul Ryan says, we've created a hammock out of a safety net. It's nonsense. And in fact, we need to be providing these people with this cash now. The Republicans have been withholding it since 3 days after Christmas. We have her back. Dr. Kelton, you're back.
I don't know what happened. I'm so sorry.
Skype croaked. Finish your thought.
Well, I was talking about the infrastructure and the amount of spending and how many folks we have. So we've got all these people that we could use. We have useful things for them to do. The more we wait, the bigger the problem becomes. And it just seems to me a no-brainer. And it was also the kind of thing that used to be a no-brainer in Washington, because infrastructure investment used to enjoy broad bipartisan support. You know, both parties understood that you invest in your nation's infrastructure, that it increases productivity. And so, you know, this is good for businesses. It's good for workers. This was just a no-brainer. And now we can't even do the sorts of things that, you know, 20 years ago, 12 years ago, were no-brainers.
Yeah, I have theories on that. I think it's largely political, and it has to do with the Democrat in the White House and sabotage and et cetera. But do you think that, first of all, do you think that another crash is coming, or do you think that this 2007-2008 thing is over?
I definitely think another crash is coming. They always do. It is, we've done nothing really to prevent the next crisis from occurring, especially in financial markets. We didn't learn the right lessons from what happened last time. So we do not have the safeguards in place, I don't think, to prevent the next crisis. As my colleague Bill Black says, we enjoy now, and I use enjoy in quotation marks, recurring and intensifying financial crisis. So not only will there be another one, but in all likelihood, it will be even worse than the last one.
Wow. So what should the average person do?
The only thing I can think of is to say that the average person needs to understand somehow that the deregulation that that we are, I think, inclined to tend to support because it's sold in such a persuasive way that, you know, there are all these unnecessary, onerous regulations. We need to re-regulate. We need to end too big to fail. We need to break up the big banks, and we need to...
So
really,
the average person needs to get politically active, basically.
They do.
Yeah,
they do.
And economically literate.
They do.
And you are making a huge contribution to that, and I thank you so much for dropping by today. We will do this again, I hope, soon.
Thank you, Tom.
Thank you. Dr. Stephanie Kelton, neweconomicperspectives.org. We'll be back with Dr. Martin Gilens.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Interesting stuff coming from the... welcome back to the program, by the way. Interesting stuff coming from the Supreme Court today. There are arguments this morning in the cell phone case. I'll recap that for you in a little bit. And also they gave the Obama administration, or the EPA,
really,
which is part of and works for the Obama administration, I mean, under our constitutional system, the authority to regulate smog causing pollution from coal-fired power plants when it crosses state lines. And which seems to make sense. You know, it's interstate pollution if it's not interstate commerce. But anyhow, we'll get into that in more detail as time goes on. But first, there's some really remarkable research that's been done lately that brings to the fore things that I think a lot of us, not just a lot of us. I don't mean to put myself in any elite class. I think in general, Americans have had this sense for at least a decade and probably more like two or three, that the rich were getting richer, the poor were getting poorer, but perhaps more importantly, the policies that the rich wanted were getting done and the policies that average working people wanted were getting ignored. And Dr. Martin Gilens, is it Gilens, sir?
Gilens.
My apologies. Dr. Martin Gilens, professor of politics at Princeton University, co-author of the book with Professor Benjamin Page of Northwestern University, of the new study, Testing Theories of American Politics, Elites, Interest Groups, and Average Citizens. I found this absolutely fascinating. Dr. Gilens, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for being with us. Can you, and the website is scholar.princeton.edu and Twitter at Princeton. If you can... give us a summary, basically, of, well, actually, even before we get into what your research found, why do this research?
Well, you know, as you just mentioned, economic inequality has been growing in this country for a number of decades now. And I think more and more people were concerned that a vicious cycle was developing where the people with the money have the power to shape political institutions in ways that further entrench their power, and that the economic inequality would be accompanied by growing political inequality. So we started to collect some data to see whether there was evidence of that and just how unequal political influence is in this country.
Mm-hmm. And what kind of data did you collect?
We looked at about 25 years worth of policy proposals. So this is all federal government policymaking and across a very wide range of policies, anything from domestic issues, foreign policies, economic, social, whatever we could get our hands on, almost 2,000 different proposed changes to federal government policy between 1981 and 2002. And for each of those proposed changes, we collected data on what ordinary citizens wanted, what percentage of them supported the proposed change, what economic elites wanted, and what interest groups wanted. And by having information on all of those actors at the same time, we were able to assess the relative importance, the relative influence of each of them in determining what, in fact, the government actually did.
Mm-hmm. If we could just clarify some terms. By economic elites, how much do you have to make to be an economic elite?
Well, so we view economic elites as not just a sort of handful of billionaires, but of thousands of people who have the resources to make substantial monetary contributions to candidates, to parties, to advocacy organizations, and so on.
So this would be the top 1%, roughly?
Well, in our analysis, we look at people at the 90th income percentile, but we view those individuals as a proxy for still wealthier people, something like the top 1%, though it's hard to say. And I think it's important to point out that there's not any sort of set line where, you know, above this amount you have influence and below that amount you don't have influence.
Right.
It's more a matter of among people who have an interest in shaping what the government does, the more money they have, the more influence they have.
Okay. And then to define the term special interest groups.
Interest groups, there's thousands of groups in Washington that lobby the government on basically anything that the government does.
Sure.
And we couldn't look at thousands of them, but we put together a list of a few dozen of the most powerful interest groups in Washington based on interviews with sort of Washington insiders, with congressional staff and with lobbyists and so on. And that list, in other work, has been shown to correspond quite closely to sort of more elaborate efforts to measure the range of interest groups that are engaged on a particular issue.
Okay.
So for us, it was everything from, you know, automobile manufacturers or defense industries to the AARP or the AFL-CIO. Most of them were business groups, as most interest organizations in Washington are, but they also included what we call mass-oriented or mass-based interest groups like unions or the AARP and so on.
What about conservation groups, Greenpeace kind of thing, the religious groups? They have a significant presence here in Washington, D.C., particularly the anti-abortion religious groups, the the anti-gay religious groups. Whatnot.
Yeah, some of those groups made it onto our list and some didn't. And you're right about the abortion groups. Those are included. Also groups like the NRA. But environmental groups were not perceived by Washington insiders as being among the most influential.
They just don't have enough money to have influence. Is that the deal?
Yes, I think that's the bottom line.
That's a sad commentary on our times. So we're talking with Dr. Martin Gillens, professor of politics at Princeton University and co-author of this brilliant new study, Testing Theories of American Politics. So you looked at the preferences of the economic elites, the top 90th percent, the 90th percentile and above income group, of special interest groups and of average citizens with regard to each one of these three groups with regard to over roughly 2,000 individual policy prescriptions, attempted legislation over the past 20 some odd, almost 30 years.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, to recap. And what did you find?
Well, we found that economic elites and interest groups have a substantial influence over government policymaking, but that ordinary citizens have essentially none. The image that I think many people still cling to of America as a place where average, middle-class individuals play some important role in determining what their government does just is not the case.
Wow. That's very disheartening. John Paul Stevens, in his dissent in Citizens United, wrote that if this decision stood, that it would cause people to give up on the political process, become cynical and stop even voting, much less participating in politics. Are we there yet?
Well, I mean, I think there's certainly a reason for cynicism and maybe even despair. Nonetheless, you know, there are ways forward. And even in light of recent Supreme Court decisions, cutting down various elements of campaign finance reform, you know, there are proposals which skirt those concerns, those restrictions, and get around the issues of First Amendment rights. So, for example, New York City has a campaign finance law where small donations get matched with public funds on a 6-to-1 basis. So small donations are worth 7 times the amount to a candidate. And that has the effect of allowing, small donors to play a much larger role and a much broader range of individuals to have a voice, not only in who wins elections, but in who is a viable candidate to begin with.
And Antonin Scalia has not tried to strike this down.
This has survived First Amendment challenges.
Yeah. Remarkable.
And in fact, there's proposals at the national level that mirror that kind of approach.
Hang on just a second, sir. We're talking with Dr. Martin Gillens of Professor of Politics at Princeton University.
This is the Tom Hartman
right?
Program.
Gillens, Professor Gillens. I'm sorry. I keep mispronouncing. Dr. Martin Gillens. We'll be right back with more. Welcome back. Dr. Gillens, you still with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay. So when you, study didn't just, drop with a thud into academia like so many do. It made its way across the blogosphere pretty rapidly and got a lot of attention.
Yeah, we were pretty amazed, I have to say.
Well, tell me about how, what kind of response have you had to it, and has that response come from quarters that give you optimism?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I guess the first thing I'd say is that it is heartening to see that there is so much interest, so much concern on a question which, I mean, we believe is at the core of, the nature of our society and our government.
Mm-hmm.
We've sort of tapped into the zeitgeist, if you will, here. And that does give me some encouragement. There is a sense of if not despair, or at least resignation. And I think a lot of the response that we've gotten is, you guys maybe have pointed out this problem or, put into kind of statistical scientific terms what we suspected, but what we really need are solutions. And, honestly, those are much harder to come by. I do think campaign finance reform is one important one. We could talk about that a little bit more.
Sure.
And I don't want to say that citizens play no role. So what we found in our work and what we've seen historically is that when, disadvantaged or underrepresented or less powerful groups are able to achieve what they want, it's because they have allies. In this case, in our work, allies among either economic elites or interest groups. And we found a variety of examples where that was how policies that are important to the middle class got passed.
How is this different from or similar to the end of the 19th century when we had the horrible crash of 1898, I think it was, and arguably the end of the Gilded Age leading to the progressive and populist revolution over the next couple of decades?
I'm not a historian, and so I wouldn't want to venture, too much, but it does seem as if there are many parallels to that period.
I don't know if you read Plutocrats by, what's her name? She was the editor of the Financial Times for years and years, Christina.
Yeah, Chrystia Freeland.
Chrystia Freeland, right. I don't want to put words in her mouth or in her book. I was very impressed by her book, but it drew some interesting parallels between that time and this. Are we in a new Gilded Age?
Well, in terms of economic inequality, there's no question about it. A portion of the country's wealth that's held by the top tenth or hundredth of 1%, is just so great. It's greater now than it was at any time since the 1920s. Income inequality has been growing for decades now. And I think, we're even seeing culturally the reflections of that as we become a more divided society, you know, gated communities and, you know, private air travel and so on,
right.
That the very rich live in a world that's, they're not even living in the same world as ordinary Americans.
Yeah, they don't have to deal with the TSA.
Exactly.
Dr. Martin Gillens is with us. He's professor of politics at Princeton University. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Harmon here with you, 20 minutes past the hour. Dr. Martin Gillens is with us, professor of politics at Princeton University, co-author with Professor Benjamin Page of Northwestern University of a new study titled Testing Theories of American Politics, Elites, Interest Groups, and Average Citizens. And just to recap, essentially what you found is that the average citizen of the United States today has virtually no say in the creation or execution of public policy and in getting laws passed that benefit them, but that special interest groups, well-funded special interest groups, and well-funded individuals, people above the 90th percentile of income, or was it income or wealth?
Income. Okay.
Of income. Have a consequential impact on the outcome of public policy. First question, you looked back almost 30 years. The Reagan Revolution is 33 years old. We've been in this era for 33 years now of what George Herbert Walker Bush referred to as voodoo economics, a very different economic perspective. I think Barack Obama was right when he said that Reagan genuinely was a revolutionary. And we kind of turned away from the Keynesian policies that animated the New Deal. Do you think that things were different prior to the 1980s?
Well, I mean, I think there is some evidence in our data that the responsiveness of government policymakers to the well-to-do has increased over the last few decades. But there's no evidence that there ever really was a time when middle-class Americans had a substantial voice in what government does. I mean, just look historically, right? Our founders thought that only property-owning white males were fit to be involved in politics.
Yeah.
And,
or at least some of our founders did, yeah.
Yeah. You know, it's not a new thing, political inequality. But the formal political equality that has expanded over the centuries, the right to vote, for example, our work shows has not been accompanied by an actual broadening of influence over what the government does.
Right. So you mentioned that you don't. I believe that you don't. You didn't. You know, one of the critiques was where are the policy prescriptions? You're not overt in them because you're doing an analytic test here. But what do you draw from this? What should we do?
Well, we should try to find ways to lessen the importance of big donations in politics. You know, the interest groups that lobby and support candidates and the wealthy individuals that we've seen sort of more and more becoming involved in the wake of Citizens United. You know, people who can spend millions of dollars, $100 million to promote their favorite candidate. I mean, this is a perversion of the political system. And, you know, the Supreme Court has been moving us in the wrong direction, in my view, in terms of campaign finance laws. But, you know, there's things we can do about it. There's ways around it. And, you know, I was mentioning the system that New York City has. The similar system has been proposed, for example, by John Sarbanes to create a sort of matching fund system at the federal level. Larry Lessig at Harvard Law School has even gone a step further and suggested what he calls democracy vouchers, where citizens would have like a coupon or a voucher that they could use at no cost to themselves to direct money from the public treasury to the candidate of their choice. And the idea here is that you're empowering the middle class, you're empowering the less well-off to participate in a system that listens at least as much to money as to votes.
Right. My favorite solution to this is the movetoamend.org group, who are suggesting you know, the Supreme Court really, since Buckley and then First National Bank versus Bilotti and then ultimately Citizens United, the Supreme Court just in the last 50 years has discovered in the First Amendment money. You know, the money is somehow protected by the First Amendment. And so we could pass a constitutional amendment saying that we're going to go back to the old notion that money was merely a behavior, use of money was a behavior rather than was speech, and that money is not speech. Just explicitly say it, that you know, money is not speech. And while we're at it, we could also say that the 14th Amendment, that Abe Lincoln didn't fight the Civil War to free the corporations, 14th Amendment, that corporations are not afforded equal protection under the law by the 14th Amendment. Would that not accomplish, or at least set the table to accomplish, pretty much everything that you're talking about?
Well, I mean, I think those would be very positive changes, and you know, I'm certainly willing to sign on to that petition.
Yeah,
obviously, the Constitution is by design a very difficult thing to amend, but that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be trying.
Yeah, well, in 71, it took...
It's worth pursuing a variety of avenues.
Yeah, I mean, we had enough people upset about the fact that they, you know, 18-year-olds were being shipped off to Vietnam, but they weren't old enough to vote in 1971, that it took 3 months and 8 days to amend the Constitution with the 26th Amendment to lower the voting age. So maybe if we could get enough people upset.
Absolutely.
Or educated. Where are you going? We have just a minute left. Where are you going with this? Are you doing more research on this? Are you taking this beyond this point?
Well, I've actually written an entire book that goes beyond what's in the paper and involves some more recent data as well as some older data from the 1960s. That's recently out in paperback. It's called Affluence and Influence. And that's a Princeton University Press book.
I wish I had known when we started. I would have been plugging it all through this talk. Affluence and Influence. And it's available right now in paperback.
That's right.
At your favorite bookseller. Affluence and Influence by Dr. Martin Gillens, G-I-L-E-N-S. And, in fact, actually, I have a note here about this. Thank you so much for dropping by today, sir.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Nice talking to you.
Very, very good talk. We will be back, and we can talk about the issues that Dr. Gillens has brought up, the issues that Dr. Kelton brought up, the question that Shane raised in the very beginning of this program. What do you do with billionaires when you can't punish them because they got so much money?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Maybe my considered eccentric solution of no billionaires, outlawing billionaires, nobillionaires.com. Good first step. And the very, very hypnopompically ugly, brought to you by the organic wine company, ecowine.com, the good Reverend Joe Hoffman. On Monday, the pastor of the First Congregational United Church of Christ in Asheville, North Carolina, joined the heads of a number of other North Carolina churches in suing the state over its gay marriage ban. In their complaint, which was filed in the Western District of North Carolina, Hoffman and his fellow plaintiffs argued that the Tar Heel State's ban on same-sex marriage violates their right to freedom of religion. They correctly believe, that officiating and performing same-sex marriages is their right under the First Amendment to the Constitution. How's that for turning the conservative arguments that same-sex marriage threatens religious freedom on its head? Well done, Reverend Hoffman. The bad, Joni Ernst. During a recent campaign event hosted by the religious right group, The Family Leader, the Iowa State candidate said that as a senator, she would choose to approve or reject federal judges depending on whether or not they understood that the Constitution comes from God. Check it out.
But making sure that they do stand firm with what our Constitution says, like Sam said, the how. But understanding where the Constitution came from and our laws, and they all did come from God.
Actually, James Madison, the father of the Constitution, was one of my ancestors. I can tell you, none of my ancestors are gods. Constitution was written by men, many of whom are very skeptical of organized religion. Most high school students can tell you that. If Joni Ernst wants to be a U.S. senator, she might want to try to relearn some of the basics of American history first. And the very, very ugly Rush Limbaugh. Everyone has an opinion on now suspended Los Angeles Clippers owner Donald Sterling, but none of them have to be as ridiculous as the hot take Rush Limbaugh had for his viewers on Monday's episode of his radio show. Check this out.
Look, this Donald Sterling business, I have to tell you something, folks. This is not news to anybody who has known of this guy. I mean, I'm telling Mr. Snerdly this morning, this guy's a big Democrat. The only reason he's in trouble right now is he did not give enough money to Obama.
All right. Actually, Sterling is a registered member of the GOP, and the idea that the outrage about his racist comments had something to do with his support or lack thereof for the Obama campaign is just absurd. Leave it to Rush to try to turn a pretty obvious story about a racist jerk into a conspiracy theory about the liberal media. That is just very, very amazing. Amazing. Anyhow, Paul in Woodinville, Washington, listening on KBCS. Hey, Paul, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Well, you know, I got a response for this. The Constitution comes from God, or they say our rights come from God, and that's really coming from the the Declaration of Independence. And my response to that is, fine, but they're protected by the Constitution, and that was written by men.
Well said. Okay? Well said.
So, yeah, I wanted to squeeze. I was hoping you'd see on the board there a question for your first guest.
Where in the world is the Milton Friedman economy theory actually working? I did sort of ask that question. I said,
you were asking about, but you know, Milton Friedman, he's just touted as this brilliant man. And whenever I've heard interviews on, he's a good table turner in a debate, but what did he ever prove? And where is a supply side Milton Friedman economy booming that we should emulate that? Where in the world is that happening?
Well, they seem to boom for a short while. I mean, look at what happened in Chile. Look at what happened in Russia. Look at what happened in some of the other, you know, Eastern European countries when they were super hyper-liberalized. Look at what happened, you know, during the Thatcher and Reagan eras very early on. You get this small artificial stimulus, although I would argue that most of that was actually very Keynesian. So,
well, I think, you know, what Reagan did was
he borrowed
a lot of money and created a lot of national debt.
Right. He borrowed $3 trillion and threw a party.
That created some jobs, but it was on borrowed money. Yeah. And so just like Lloyd Benson said, I can give you the illusion of wealth.
Right. Yeah, I forgot about Lloyd Benson. You're right.
That's what he said to Dan Quayle.
Yep, that's right. And my comment back in those days was, give me a $3 trillion credit card and I'll show you what it looks like to live large. You know,
he said to Dan Quayle just before, he said, Jack Kennedy was a friend of mine.
That's right.
You're no Jack Kennedy.
That's right. Brilliant. Paul, one of our underwriters, proflowers.com, has given us some free gift certificates, and I would like to pass one along to you if you would like.
I would love that.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Let me put you on hold, and Danielle will get your information. Oh, damn. I hit the drop button instead of the hold button. Paul, I know you're listening. Call right back. And if you don't get through, because it looks like all the lines are full, if you don't get through, call back in a little bit. But call back, and Danielle will get your information. Actually, she might be able to dig it out of the database, because it does. We're good. Okay, cool. Morris in Long Beach, California. Listening on KPFK. Hey, Morris, what's up?
Happy days are here again, Professor.
Okay.
Oprah Winfrey and Rachel Sterling are in talks right now, in negotiations right now, about the sale of the Clippers. Now, Commissioner Silver, he's unaware of the negotiations. However, his lifetime ban of Mr. Sterling has coerced a little pressure here. So now we can, you know, get back to what's important, Professor, and that's Game 5.
Okay. I'm assuming that's sports talk, right? Game 5?
That's the truth. Because
the next game in the playoffs,
Sterling
right?
Sterling was to distract. That's the devil.
Yeah.
I'm a Clippers fan. We're in our 92nd game with the preseason, the playoffs. We've come a long way. We've got two first-team All-Pro guys on our squad.
Yeah.
Okay, we can do something this year, and we're not going to let the devil take this from us. So go ahead, Oprah, and go ahead, Mr. Sterling, and get it together and let the narrative be Oprah is buying the Clippers and not the comments of Donald Sterling.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
There you go. Morris, before you go, might this also not be a good opportunity for us to have a conversation about whether we really want to have in the United States the same thing that the old Roman Empire did, which is the local oligarchs, the local billionaires who ruled over the local towns around Rome would sponsor individual gladiators, and then the gladiators would go into the arena and, you know, they'd fight to the death. And now we've just reinvented that with our sports teams. And, you know, do we really want to have oligarchs owning our sports teams? Shouldn't our communities own them, or shouldn't the players themselves own them? Should we be looking at workers' co-ops?
Well, Professor, I can appreciate what you're saying, but I'm a fan, and my pastor says that the word fan comes from the word fanatic, which means you can't put us in charge of anything.
So
right now, we just want to look at game five.
You just want to watch the damn game.
Okay,
I got it, Morris. I got it. Thanks a lot for the call. It's great to hear from you, and I appreciate your fanaticism. Michael in Farmington, Maine. Hey, Michael, what's on your mind?
Hey, Mr. Professor Hartman, how are you today?
I'm fine. I'm not a professor, though. What's up?
Oh, I'm sorry. But one of the problems I'm having is that I should say that I'm black, and I call the hospital sometimes, and then I'm trying to find a private physician, and when I tell them that I'm black, they tell me that that doesn't matter, and when I tell them that, you know, their application for me to fill out for the physician asks me what type of race I am, it does matter. Well, they take offense to that and hang up. Now, I was wondering about, you know, if I could get your advice, and one other thing, and then I'll hang up, is that I own my property in Industry, Maine. Well, there's a private road next to my property where they put a pole up with all the residents that live on it on my property. So when I call a federal agency and the state and the sheriff department, they tell me not to rock the boat and to let them have my property. Even though I'm the one paying the taxes, they aren't paying taxes. So, you know, with
you mean they put up a pole with the names, that, like pointing to people's houses, that kind of thing?
Yes.
Yeah, okay. I've seen that. You know, those are not uncommon in rural areas, and they're considered part of the commons, even if it's on your private property. I mean, because there is no public property out there other than the middle of the road, other than the road itself.
Well, I have a warranty deed that says that from the road over where my property begins.
Right, so where do they put the sign?
My property. Huh?
Where do they put the sign?
They put it on my property.
No, but I mean, where should they put it if not on your property?
They should put it on down the road on their property.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, you know, that's something to take up with your local town council. With regard to why your doctor's application or, you know, fill out the information form asks your race, is because there are some medical conditions, you know, like sickle cell anemia, for example, that white people don't get and black people do. And there are probably, you know, things on the opposite side. And so race, from a physician's point of view, actually does matter, at least, you know, having some information about it.
Right. But when I call the operators at the physician's office and I tell them that I'm black, they tell me that doesn't matter. And when I tell them, well, how come the application says it matters, they get upset.
Well, I think it's because they think you're playing word games with them. They mean it doesn't matter. Like, we'll see you whether you're black or white. We're not racists here. But you know, medically, yeah, there is a reason to know not just somebody's race, but somebody's entire. Thank you, Michael, for the call. Somebody's entire medical history. I mean, you know, did both your parents die of a heart attack at an early age? That's something your doctor should know. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
So what do you think? The NBA has $2.5 million fine, is that it? 2.25, something like that. It's amazing. Amazing. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And I just FYI, I mean, I lived in rural Vermont. I lived in rural New Hampshire. I can tell you where the Salem Children's Village is. There's a whole bunch of little dirt roads that go off of the main road that go back to people's private homes. And wherever the tree is, where you can see it from the road, and it's going to be on somebody's property, they put up the arrows with the names. And so, on the other hand, legally it is a taking. You know, your neighbors have appropriated your property, and presumably you could sue them if you want. But they're neighbors. I mean, you know, I agree with the advice not to rock the boat. But what can I say? John in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Hey, John, thanks for watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. What's up?
How are you? Welcome. Yeah, I, you know, was really appalled when I heard about what the owner of the Clippers, Mr. Sterling, had said. But what was worse was just his attitude that, like, the players were nothing more than, you know, like slaves of his, and he was the team, and they were nothing.
Well, and the same thing with his girlfriend. She was his property as well.
Yeah, and so I think a fitting punishment for him would be to lose that property without being compensated. For something as egregious as what he did, I think that's not inappropriate. And I think the same with the bankers that, you know, did create the economic crisis and meltdown. They should have been removed. It should have been expropriated by the government and then resold. They did
as Reagan did with the SNLs.
Right. And they did that in Sweden, and it worked beautifully.
Yep, in 97.
And that's the problem, is that there is no punishment for these people. And I think that an appropriate punishment for Mr. Sterling would be to lose the Clippers. The state of California should then own the Clippers, and they could either own it or sell it. But then the black community should get all of the profits from the team to be used for affirmative action programs and scholarships and things like that, because black people have suffered quite a bit, and they are second-class citizens, and we have not really made reparation to them for, slavery. And so they should be compensated, and this is an opportunity to do that.
Yeah. The problem that you encounter when you start getting into those kind of things is the BIA problem. I have a friend who's a Native American and worked very, very hard to get his BIA card, his Bureau of Indian Affairs card, to prove that he had enough Indian blood in him to qualify as a member of his tribe and therefore be eligible for benefits associated with the tribe. And it gets very messy and it gets very confusing. But in terms of the expropriation, here's a proposal based on what you just suggested that occurred to me. Maybe the rule change in the NBA needs to happen. They fined him $2.25 million or $2.5 million, which was the maximum fine that the NBA provides for. When he bought that team, he paid, what, $15, $20, $25 million for it? And it's worth now $1 billion? The fine that can be appropriated should be at least equal to the value of the team. And that's the NBA rule that should be placed. Thank you, John, for the call. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, fair and only slightly unbalanced. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com, Ellen Ratner's little charity. And it's Nay Day. Bob Nay, author of Sideswiped, and former member of Congress and current reporter with the Talk Radio News Service, is on the line with us. Hello, Robert.
Hello, Tom. How are you?
I am very well, thank you, and I hope the same is true for you.
Yes, sir.
So, what's going on in the world today?
Well, it's kind of zero tolerance day. Of course, we know now about the NBA ruling, which, reading between the lines, I guess they cannot. It's not like Marge Schott and the antitrust laws of baseball, where, you know, she could be forced to sell a team. I guess they're going to try to force him, but it looks like they can't actually make him do it. They'll try everything under the sun.
Well, the fans are making him do it. I mean, they're staying away in droves. The advertisers are running away. It's like,
that's right.
You know, if he doesn't sell now, he's going to, every day that goes by, he's going to lose another $5 million.
Whereas in baseball, due to the antitrust laws and the way it's situated and set up, they could say to Marge Schott, you are done. You know, you're going to sell. But, you know, the fine, he's a billionaire, so I heard what you said about the fine. That's so perpy, $2.5 million is nothing, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he could file a court action, who knows. But dovetailing on that zero tolerance, this kind of shocked me, this story coming out of Washington, just coming out fresh right now. House Majority Leader Eric Cantor, the number two guy in the House Republican Conference, said to Congressman Representative Vance McAllister of Louisiana that he needs to resign from office immediately.
This is the kissing congressman, the guy who was caught kissing his seat.
And Eric Cantor said it's not good enough that you're not running, and I've been through this myself where I wasn't going to run and I remain, but he said, we want you to leave now, Eric Cantor said. He said, we are adopting a zero-tolerance policy.
Whoa, is he going to go back and kick out David Vitter?
Well, and a few others. I did some Twitters today myself on it, on the topic. I mean, really, you know, it's not moral. It's not prudent. It's not good for, you know, the married guy to obviously kiss a staffer.
And it might be illegal in Mississippi, but who knows?
Yeah. What exactly? But, you know, to actually say you need to resign because we have zero tolerance on this standard is, you know, may really put a lot of people. What is zero tolerance on what standards now?
Yeah, you were.
And I just was surprised at this.
You were a member of Congress for a number of years, a good Republican, and I'm wondering if you would mind speculating on what percentage of your peers, and whether it was partisan or not. I'm suspecting it probably isn't. But what percentage of your peers were at least occasionally having affairs on their wives?
I think about, you know, if I had to guess a number, I would say about a third, somewhere around a third were either, you know, and they're good, and there are a lot of good people out there, and who am I to judge? You know, I was a part of the bad part of the system, but I would say there's about a third that would have a serious problem to meet this standard.
Well, that's, I mean, you know, the statistic is that more than 45% of women and 65% of men, it's been a couple of years since we did a show on this, have had an affair at least once during their marriage. Now, that's different than, you know, having ongoing regular affairs kind of things.
Right.
But, you know, to think that any institution is going to be absolutely free of that kind of thing.
And there are high alcohol usage rates. We all know that. It's an open secret in D.C. So do they start with that, too, where the number two Republican comes back and says, well, too much use of alcohol, obviously.
Well, that's then the number one Republican is going to have a real problem, isn't he?
There may not be anybody left.
Yeah.
So, left. I just looked at this, and I really wondered where it came from.
Yeah.
In the sense of what are they trying to do? Are they that afraid in the election year on the heels of Congressman Grimm?
Or was Eric Cantor just looking for a quick, cheap headline? Keep his name out there.
I don't know on this one.
Or trying to take the steal the thunder away from, or even distract from John Boehner's apologizing for his saying that the Republicans said, don't make me do it about immigration.
I wondered about that, too, because there's no doubt there's a rivalry between Cantor and Boehner, and if Boehner turns the wrong way, I think Eric Cantor's going to challenge him after November.
Yeah, Cantor's middle name is Brutus, isn't it?
Yes, he's going to challenge him. But today, Speaker Boehner did a couple of things. One, he supposedly has this secret deal on immigration, supposedly, which, you know, the Democratic side is saying, yes, you know, there's been these talks, so he's got this secret deal, which he denies now. But on top of it, he apologizes to the conference for making fun of them, which he said, you know, you tease the one you love, but you shouldn't say something public. But I think he only did that. Normally he wouldn't care because he knows this is causing him a lot of trouble, and this is bleeding over into a public policy issue of, you know, making really light of something that's a pretty serious issue.
Yeah, yeah. So Eric Cantor has come out. Basically, Boehner was saying that we're not going to get immigration reform, which has passed the Senate, by the way. It's stuck. Boehner is the roadblock. That we're not going to get it because he couldn't get enough Republicans to go along with it. So he's not going to, you know, he's going to, what's his name, Hastert rule it or whatever. But then Cantor came out and clarified, or no, Boehner himself clarified and said, what I really meant to say was that the American people don't trust the president to implement this law, and therefore we're not going to pass it. What kind of crazy talk is that?
Well, and on top of it, Boehner is now, you know, during his time as speaker, historically using the Hastert rule at his convenience like a coat. Gets a little warm, sure. You take it off or you put it on. I mean, you either have this rule or you don't have this rule, where you either open this up for votes of the full membership and Democrats and Republicans combine to pass a vote, like
right.
we used to always do,
right.
or, you know, you implement this hypocritically when you just sort of want out of something or you don't like it. But he's sending mixed signals all over the place on this. And in his caucus, there are Republicans who are saying, wait a minute, we have to address this issue. So right. I think this is a huge, huge benchmark before the election for the Republicans to either, you know, get in line with this, or it's going to hurt them.
Yeah, the Hispanic vote is not inconsequential, is the bottom line here, isn't
correct.
It? Yeah, okay.
Correct.
Bob Ney. Bob, I always love talking politics with you. Thanks so much for dropping by today.
Thank you, sir.
Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. And Bob's book is Sideswiped, and it's really worth reading. He actually details crimes that John Boehner committed.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Bad news. Our friend Tim Carpenter, who has been in our studio many times over the years, and shared with you and me on the air his struggle with the recurrence of metastatic melanoma, died last night. He's the co-founder of Progressive Democrats of America and an amazing, amazing fellow. And so I wanted to have a mutual friend of his on and just do a brief remembrance of Tim Carpenter. John Nichols is on the line with us. Hey, John.
It's good to be with you, Tom. It's unfortunate to be with you in this on this date, in this circumstance.
Yeah. In a way, I mean, it depends on how you think of death. I am of the opinion that Tim is in the light now. He's part of everything.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I think Tim would be there as well. I don't mourn for him. I mourn for us.
Yeah, exactly. It's
We need him.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what funerals are for. They're for the living, not the dead. But in my opinion, and I hope, you know, when I die, people have a party and celebrate my life rather than mourn my death. And so let's talk a little bit about celebrating the life of Tim Carpenter and also the work that he started that it continues, Progressive Democrats of America, pdamerica.org. There will be a gig going on the 10th of May in Northampton, Massachusetts, which is where Tim lived or near to where Tim lived. And I'm going to be there. You're going to be there. Bernie's going to be there. There's a bunch of us who are Jim Hightower. Just to reboot that and remind people about that, you can sign up for that and learn more about that over at pdamerica.org. And that's also where we're going. I believe that's where we're going to be presenting Bernie with the 10,000 plus signatures in the petition that he run as a Democrat.
I think it's all in a little bit of flux on timing and things, because what had been planned in one perspective now moves into another. I think we all anticipated Tim would be there. And now we'll be remembering, and there's a little change that occurs in that, I guess.
Yeah.
But yes, Tim had spearheaded a national drive to convince Senator Bernie Sanders to run in the Democratic primaries for president of the United States. Now, some of our Green friends and some of our independent politics activist friends have actually been urging Senator Sanders to go in other routes. And so, you know, there was this, I have to say, this very good-spirited competition among different activist groupings following Bernie Sanders' indication that he might be considering a presidential run to draw him to one of the different routes.
Right.
And Tim was at the forefront of saying to him, yeah, hey, let's get into the Democratic Party not to be overwhelmed by it, but to overwhelm it.
Right.
And
push the party to the left, basically.
Well, in fact, that's the best way as we talk about Tim Carpenter. And Tim would want us to have started exactly where we started on this conversation. But the best way to understand Tim Carpenter is that he learned a lot from Michael Harrington. Michael Harrington, the great Democratic Socialist activist of the 1970s and 1980s with DSA and other groups. Michael Harrington worked within the Democratic Party, but he said that he only did so, not because he loved Democrats or something like that. He did so because he said this is the institution that, by and large, a lot of voters identify with a set of issues. And Harrington always said that it was his job to seek the left wing of the possible, to go as far as it was humanly possible within our current political system to achieve progressive left-wing results. Tim Carpenter picked up that baton, and to a greater extent than I think anybody else, and I have immense respect for others who do similar work, but I think Tim Carpenter kept alive that vision. And the key to it is a set of principles. Tim Carpenter was willing to form a coalition with almost anyone, but he was never willing to form a coalition for almost any idea. The coalition he would form had to be for a progressive purpose. It had to be to achieve an end that was progressive. And so what Tim did was make himself immensely useful as an organizer, as a strategist, as a activist, so much so that often political players who didn't always share all of his, you know, radical passion for economic and social justice would still invite him into the room.
Yeah.
And once he was there, he pulled those rooms to the left.
Yep, and he did it very well. He started out, just some notes here that you sent me that some of the stuff I didn't even know. He was a teenage volunteer in Orange County for McGovern in 72. He worked on the Tom Hayden campaign in 76. He was a member of the Catholic Worker Movement, homeless activists sleeping on the streets. He was part of the anti-nuclear movement, closing plants, and close to Jackson Brown and Bonnie Raitt on the whole disarmament thing. Jesse Jackson Rainbow Coalition, he was on the 88 campaign staff. He was on Jerry Brown's staff and a strategist in 1992. He was, throughout the 90s and the 2000s, a key player in a variety of anti-war and anti-militarism coalitions. He was the deputy campaign manager for Dennis Kucinich in 2004. He was the co-founder and national director, of course, of PDA, Progressive Democrats of America, PDAmerica.org, the champion of the inside-outside strategy, and a key ally of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. I would say he was even, one of the people who really helped pull that caucus together and whip it into shape. I'm not a big fan of the great man theory of history. On the other hand, occasionally really extraordinary people come along, and Tim is one of them. What's going to fill this void?
Well, I read a pretty good column today by Tom Hartman with the wonderful closing line, "Tag, you're it."
Yeah, but I'm not gonna run Progressive Democrats of America.
Too, but I'm saying that core message that, you know, when you have somebody like this, the only way you really honor him is by a lot of people picking it up, right,
yeah,
and taking it on. But I do think that folks who are listening who may not have known Tim or only knew him briefly through the great forum that you gave him over many years. They should understand, if you met Tim, nothing about this guy said great man. Nothing about him said, you know, rock star, you know, the smartest guy in the room, the best strategist you'd meet, the most determined organizer. He was those things. Very, very often that was the case. But Tim Carpenter's genius, and this is an important thing to learn, was that when he walked in the room, if there was a presidential candidate there or if there was a rock star there who knew Tim Carpenter and who respected Tim Carpenter, if he heard there were, you know, eight young activists who'd just shown up, you know, driven, you know, from a couple states over to attend the event, and they were sitting over in a corner drinking Cokes, he would go sit down with them.
Yeah.
And he, because to him, what mattered was to go into a room that had 100 people in it, 50 of them committed, 25 of them interested, 25 of them just dragged along by a friend. He wanted 100 committed activists to come out of the room. And right. So he focused on the newcomers, the people on the edges of things. And I want to tell you something. There are people who are activists today who in many cases have been activists for 20, 30 years. They never thought they were going to be activists. They were drawn in by Tim Carpenter.
Yeah.
And the way that they were drawn in was because he made them understand that they could be a part of this thing.
Yeah.
They didn't have to be perfect. They didn't have to know everything. If they wanted to get engaged on issues of economic and social justice and peace, Tim was ready to pick them up. He'd get them in his beat-up car. He'd play Dylan on the stereo. They'd head to the next event. And then you'd go out and make something happen.
There you go. Hang on just a second, Tom. We're going to get stepped on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation, thenation.com, about Tim Carpenter, pdamerica.org. Thank you, John.
It's an honor to be with you, Tom.
You too. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Trip, watching Free Speech TV in Tomball, Texas. Hey, Trip, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom. I enjoy listening to your show today. And I'd like to mention that I am a North Houston activist. I'm a part of this group called the Houston Free Thinkers. I'm also part of the Alliance of Austin Agorists. My comment, I'm a political science major and sociology minor and philosophy minor. I have a lot of, you know, I guess contradicting ideas and information that I hold that I just try and test and weigh out. But concerning the how to punish the uber rich in this country, I wasn't following the whole. I don't really follow
when
the
they
NBA.
Commit crimes. Let's make that clear.
Well, of course. When they commit crimes, I don't want to punish rich people just for being rich. But
right.
I mean, when they commit crimes,
right.
I mean it does. I mean, I fought for the reinstatement of Citizens United when I did Occupy Lubbock back in. I mean, when I wasn't around for Citizens United, but I know it did a lot of good things. But now after a couple of years past Occupy and stuff, I've been really disillusioned by, you know, the political arena and just how stuff works in this country. And I had a question: if amending the Constitution, I mean, would it be pointless if elitists and politicians feel that they're above the law anyway?
Well, they do. They do right now. And the Citizens United decision that essentially said that money is protected by the First Amendment and corporations are protected by the 14th Amendment. If we were to undo those two things by passing the move to amend amendment, the amendment that Mark Pocan and three colleagues have introduced or co-sponsored in the House of Representatives now, what it would do is it would create the political space to allow politicians to say we are going to get money out of politics. Now, a lot of people hear that and they go, well, you know, why would they do that? They would do that because both Democrats and Republicans, with a few exceptions, you know, I suspect Darrell Issa, for example, the richest guy in the House of Representatives, is one of those exceptions. He can finance his own campaign. He could squash any candidate who runs against him like a bug with his own money. So he likes the fact that he can spend unlimited funds. But most of these guys, most of these men and women, they spend half their time fundraising, and they're sick and tired of it, regardless of party. So there's a growing willingness, a sense on the part of politicians, which I think happened in the late 1800s and early 1900s, which led to the Tillman Act in 1907, and it led to McCain-Feingold back in the 1990s, that's of politicians to say, enough already, enough. We want to limit money in politics so that we don't have to spend all our time fundraising, so we can become legislators. And so you've got legislators who are starting to feel that way. You've got businesses that are getting sick and tired of constantly being hit up by politicians. And basically, the only people who still like the things the way they are the billionaires. And so your question is, what about the billionaires? Well, once the legislators are freed of money in politics, then they can do like Teddy Roosevelt did, start breaking up trusts. They can do like Woodrow Wilson did and start raising taxes on billionaires. Well, Teddy Roosevelt, the estate tax, Woodrow Wilson, the income tax, put into place these systems that will deconstruct these edifices of wealth and return America to some semblance of rationality economically. Tripp, thanks for the call. With you, 21 minutes past the hour, and Mike in Lomita, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hello, Mr. Hartman. Just wanted to share a little good news. This afternoon, I called both my senators' offices to voice support for a raise in the minimum wage, and I'd urge everyone that is into that issue to do likewise. Also, I saw on the internet that a federal judge has overturned the voter ID law in Wisconsin.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Whoa. Normally on the breaks, I'm surfing the web. I haven't had an opportunity here. But Shane is tracking that. Yep, he's nodding his head. Yes, indeed. Oh, wow. That's incredible. Okay. Yep, did the judge stay his own stay, or has it actually been frozen? Well, we'll find out. We'll report back. So, Mike, thanks for that.
Myself. No problem. Oh, by the way, on the Sterling thing, if the numbers I've heard thrown out are approximately accurate, he was fined about 0.1% of his net worth by the NBA.
Right. See, I think that, you know, when the NBA, I'm guessing that when the NBA set $2.5 million as a fine, that was back in the days when you could buy an NBA team for $15 or $20 million. And so basically they were saying that the fine could be up to, 10 or 15% of the value of the team. And really the NBA needs to change their rules so that the fines can be literally 10 or 15% of the value of a team, or even 20 or 25% of the value of the team. So if a team is worth $1 billion now, the fine could be $250 million. And then you would actually be, arguably anyway, punishing the billionaire for their behavior. I won't say crime. This is a social crime, not a legal crime. But, with the banksters, I mean, we need to actually be putting people in jail. But good point, Mike. Thanks a lot for the call, and thanks for listening to KPFK. Tina in Jay, New York. Hey, Tina, what's up?
Hi, sir. I wanted to piggyback on to some comments you had made last week about, for example, if a white couple were in a restaurant and another couple were seated before them, they would not deem that due to their race. And there's an author, I guess he's a sociologist, he's a wonderful guy, Tim Wise, who has studied racism in America and white privilege in America. And the idea of an African American in America not being seated, failing a class, not doing well, they carry the burden of their race with them. Something that white people really, at least I can say, I know nothing about. If I fail, if I'm not seated first, if I'm not treated well, I never attribute it to my race, my skin color.
Because you're white.
But yes, I am a white woman. But African Americans, and I would have to say Native Americans and et cetera, people with a lot of melanin in their skin, they must bear that for their whole race. That's just the way it's been set up and structured for 150 years now.
Yeah, and there's a study that came out recently that found that when teachers were grading tests, when they were told in advance, and it wasn't actually even true, but when they were told in advance that certain papers were written by African Americans and others were written by whites, they found more mistakes in the papers written by the African Americans. When they didn't know who wrote which, they didn't find more mistakes.
And, you know, as someone that does not suffer that indignity, it's a soundbite. But for someone that suffers that indignity every day, that is debilitating. That eats at your soul. And that is unfair and unwarranted. And we will reap what we sow. And we know better. Yeah. We know better today. We know better. Whether we want to admit it, whether we want to do the hard work or not, we know better, and we will reap what we sow. And I just wanted to make that comment.
Yeah, well, you did, and you did a very good job of that, Tina. And I think that this is the big challenge for white people who get it, is to educate other white people about what white privilege is, because, frankly, I'll bet 90% of white people don't know what white privilege is. Tina, thank you for the call. Patricia in Sacramento. Hey, Patricia, what's up?
Oh, hey, Tom. Two quick things, and I call it bankster news. One is, I don't know if you saw the report about Bank of America miscalculating their capital ratios.
Yes, I saw it in Financial Times yesterday.
They were ordered to stop paying out their dividends to their shareholders.
Yep.
It kind of makes me wonder what else they're hiding, not just B of A, but makes me wonder if J.P. Morgan and Goldman Sachs actually have the reserves in place should some major loss happen.
Yep.
And then last but not least, Tom, I don't know if you read that they are now creating, the top five banks are creating credit default swaps overseas because they're pretty much out of the hands of the regulators.
That's right.
So they're recreating this whole mess that we saw.
And I think that the regulators are seeing that the banks are recreating the whole mess of 2007. And that's one of the reasons they're starting to get increasingly hysterical about there actually being bank reserves.
Yes. And Tom, if I may, I just want to remind your listeners that why I'm really afraid and why I think this is dangerous is in 2008 when Goldman Sachs, B of A bought out Merrill Lynch. Their derivatives, I think, which totaled $50 trillion, were insured under FDIC. And I believe some of Goldman's and J.P. Morgan's derivatives were insured under FDIC, meaning if we should have a major loss, FDIC would not be able to secure our deposits.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
I think you need to double-check that, because I'm pretty sure the derivatives are not FDIC insured. But I can tell you that FDIC insurance will not cover all the claims that would be hit with it right now. Thank you for the call. Yep, sure enough, Judge Lynn Edelman, U.S. District Judge Lynn Edelman, federal judge in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee. There were two cases that were combined. One was put forward by a group called the League of United Latin American Citizens, and the other was the ACLU and the Advancement Project. And they basically said that the voter ID requirement, that the people show a state-issued photo ID at the polls, well, the judge said that it would impose an unfair burden on poor and minority voters, and therefore violated the U.S. Constitution's guarantee of equal protection. It violated the 14th Amendment, and in fact said that the law was too flawed to be fixed by legislative amendments. In other words, good luck, Scott. Scott Walker says that he's going to appeal this. Actually, Attorney General J.B. Van Hollen says, we will appeal. The judge basically said, you know, the state has not demonstrated that there is any voter fraud in Wisconsin. Therefore, there's no need for a law that places a substantial burden, particularly on poor and minority people, to solve a problem that does not exist. It's really very simple. It's going to be very interesting because, you know, what has happened here is that the Reich has sold this fantasy that there are like busloads of Hispanics who are here fresh from Mexico being taken into voting places and voting in for Democrats, or that there are busloads of black people fresh out of church who are being driven from voting precinct to voting precinct to voting precinct so that they can vote multiple times for Democratic candidates. Neither of these things has ever happened. At least has never happened. I mean, you know, yeah, last year there was a woman who was prosecuted. She was actually a poll worker. She went to prison for voting twice. And she was a Democrat. But she went to jail. They found one. Right? I mean, but, you know, Breitbart and buddies, I mean, they will come up with, you know, this is like the Swift Boat veterans. I mean, this thing is, has taken on a life of its own. The right wing, they've got their story. They are not going to deviate from it. It's just amazing. Anyhow, Tim Carpenter, my friend, Tim, I miss you. Tim and I had a number of conversations about his impending death. The last time I saw him in person was right here in the studio. Last time I had a serious conversation with him about this, though, was, gee, I don't know, about 6 months ago. We were in California, and Lily Tomlin and I did a fundraiser for PDA. And I will be doing another one in the same place, in fact, in L.A. in June, I think. And Tim told me that he was starting to use the pain patches and that he was having to, you know, start taking narcotics, you know, serious painkillers, and that they weren't getting him high or anything. They were just reducing the pain. And that's when you know it's really, really bad pain. And that the cancer had metastasized in his ribs and, as I recall, his shoulder and his lungs. So it's tough to lose a friend. It's tough to lose, you know, one of the really great activists in America. But Tim would have said, you know, tag, you're it. He would have said, you're the activist now. Right? Tim's not around. It's up to us. Brett in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Brett, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I've enjoyed your show today.
Thank you.
On regards to your friend and activism, I've been thinking. I have a thought, and that is, on your show, give us more information on how to become more active.
Oh, it's very, very simple. Show up. You find an organization. PD America is one. PDAmerica.org. Move to Amend is another.org. MoveOn.org is another. DemocracyForAmerica.com. Jim Dean's organization is another. Ben and Jerry have one. Progressive Majority, I think. I don't remember the name, but Ben and Jerry started one. There's probably a good solid dozen really good nonprofit progressive groups out there, and a lot of local ones. There is a bus project in Oregon, for example, that Jefferson Smith helped start. A bunch of good progressive organizations that are doing good work. And just, you know, call them up, go to one of the meetings, meet a few people, find out what's going on, find out where your passion is, where your passion intersects with their activities. You may find one that, you know, they're really just not into the same kind of things you are. And just find one that's, you know, one might be into climate change, another one might be into getting money out of elections. You know, I mean, whatever floats your boat, hook up with them and just start showing up. It's really, really simple. It just requires that first step of catapulting yourself out of the, you know, out of the sofa. Make sense?
It does. And on that line, I think I'm involved. I care passionately about environmental issues, et cetera. But the more I listen to your show, the more I read the newspapers. I work for the local periodical here, and we print the New York Times, USA Today, Wall Street Journal. So I get to read those papers on a regular and daily basis. And I think the single most important thing to do is to get money out of politics, then we can elect people that will carry forward the other issues that are so pertinent for our country.
Yeah, you're reflecting my thinking. I agree absolutely with that. And so movetoamend.org would be a great place to start. And at the same time, go to greenpeace.org and say, hey, I want to be part of what you guys are doing.
Great. That I appreciate that. And that was one thing. And then on a local level, how do we become more involved in – I'm a Democrat.
Right.
Don't love all the Democrats.
Right. But they need you in the party. That's the thing. And this is most of these groups have local chapters, and most of their local chapters have just been started by somebody like yourself, Brett, who just said, you know, hey, I'd like to do something. Okay, I'm going to add my address and say, you know, 1 month a year, even, or one night a year, or one night a month, people can come over to my house and we'll get together and watch a video together, or have a conversation, or invite a speaker in, or invite our congressman to come by and have a little town hall. And whatever it may be, however that group does it, and become part of that local group. But similarly, you will find that your Democratic Party has local meetings. And if you show up for those local meetings and bring along enough friends, you might be able to take it over.
Excellent. Thank you for the, and I would just encourage you to do more of that. I don't know, what shall I say? Selling
okay.
to your listeners.
You got it.
I want to do more.
Yeah, that's it. This is the last chapter of my book, Screwed, tells the story of three people, one of whom still regularly calls into this radio show, who showed up and took over. One of them helped take over the Democratic Party in Colorado. One of them helped take over the city council of the Democratic Party in Oregon. And I'm forgetting the third one. It's been 5 years since I wrote the book. But it tells the story of three people who just showed up, and as a consequence of showing up, actually their work had tremendous impact, tremendous consequence. But you won't know until you show up. So, you know, it's like, and most of these groups have a website where you can find out who the local people are, and you can just call them up and say, hey, you know, what time, where do I go, what do I do? Drinking Liberally is another great group. You know, where and then there's a film. You know, viewing liberally, where they get together and watch films if you're not into drinking. But, drinking liberally is all over the country. And they meet in bars. And, you know, it's, I know a couple of people who, you know, not only got activists, but also got a mate. it's like, because you're, hey, you know. So there's lots of opportunities out there. And drinkingliberally.org, I'm pretty sure, is their website. So, Brett, thanks a lot for the call. Good luck on that. Gant in Thompson Station, Tennessee. What's up, Gant? You wanted to talk about Mr. Sterling?
Oh, wow. I cannot believe it. Hey, Tom, how are you, man?
Good.
All right. First of all, please bear with me. Sterling was caught on tape making supremacist comments in regards to his girlfriend posing with good-looking, cool athletes that happened to be black.
Right.
And his response is considered a racist statement, which I believe anybody would agree. He's also made statements that those black guys, well, in other words, those black guys would be nothing if it weren't for me. I gave
right.
them their mansions.
Yeah, he said that
millions.
Basically about his team. Yeah, he was exhibiting a plantation owner mentality.
Right, exactly. Okay. But it is obviously, in my mind, I'm looking at the psychology of this, and if you will, bear with me, because I'm...
I can't. We got about 5 seconds here, Gant. Were you
okay,
trying to say...
Okay,
this?
I'm sorry. It's the psychology of the 1%.
I think you're absolutely right. I think you just nailed it. You just absolutely nailed it. Thank you. Thanks, Gant.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And we'll be right back with more of the news of the day, your thoughts and my thoughts, and all of our commentary. Take care. Yeah, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. I just, you know, every now and then you have an emergency email you've got to respond to. So... Back to the phone lines. Barbara in Los Angeles. Hey, Barbara.
Yeah, I want to talk about renters' rights briefly.
Sure, and thanks for listening to KPFK, by the way.
Sure.
Go for it.
Well, I'm concerned because now that there's a lot of people searching for rental housing, and there's a new bubble that I understand is forming with rental properties, I'm concerned about renters' rights and availability of apartments. Mm-hmm. And I live in an apartment that's under rent control, and I'm really glad because they've tried several times to get me out illegally, but because I'm under rent control, I've been protected. So I'm really concerned for the renters' rights. And I hear sometimes on conservative radio, they really slam the rent control ordinances, and I don't think that's right. Those of us that rent need places, too.
So you know what's so ironic, Barbara, is that the conservatives who slam rent control are the same conservatives who are big fans of Proposition 5, which is basically property tax control. It fixes, it was proposed and passed in California back in the 1970s, as I recall, or maybe the early 80s. Old Howard Jarvis and his, you know, Prop 13. And, you know, it said that your property taxes could not go up as long as you owned your house. And it's created wild dislocations in the property tax system in California on the one hand. On the other hand, it's let people keep their houses as their neighborhoods have gentrified, which has been a big deal for people in particularly ethnic communities in places like San Francisco. So, you know, you could, I think that you could make an intellectual argument for or against rent control or Prop 13, but I think the argument in favor of both is probably a little stronger.
Well, that was all I wanted to say.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for the call, Barbara. Very nice to hear from you, and thanks for listening to KPFK. I appreciate it. Kim in Los Angeles, who's also listening to KPFK. Hey, Kim, you wanted to talk about the Bundy Ranch?
Yeah, Tom, I appreciate your show and your take on the wide variety of topics you address. I'd like your take on this one. It seems when we look at the situation there with Bundy and the federal government allowed itself to be backed down, essentially.
Yes.
And withdrew. I mean, they
yes.
confiscated the guy's cows and then they let him back and then they withdrew.
Yes.
I'm wondering, what is your take on the government's strategy in handling this case?
I think that Barack Obama was actually very wise in this regard. He did not do what Clinton and Janet Reno did with Waco and, you know, go in with the tanks. He said, we're not going to have any loss of life on my watch. The people that they're dealing with are right-wing crazies. They need to, you know, the FBI needs to be following these people and keeping track of them, and I'm sure they are. And they need to take Cliven Bundy's property from him and freeze his bank accounts, and I'm sure they will. And, you know, there are ways to do it that are less visible and less forceful. I'm going to be talking tonight on the radio, on the TV show, both Free Speech TV and RTTV on The Big Picture in about an hour and 10 minutes. We're going to open the show with a conversation with Chris Hedges about this very topic and how the people who were members of the Occupy movement are now being prosecuted in ways that are destroying their lives. And but that ain't happening so far to the right wing. Kim, thanks for the call. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Chris Hedges has a new piece out talking about how many of the people who have been arrested around the country in Occupy movements are basically finding themselves in positions where the only way to get out of a real disaster or going to prison is to plead guilty to a minor felony, but a felony nonetheless, and take a long probation. And this does two things. Number one, because they pled guilty to a felony, they can never vote again. They are going to have a challenge getting a job ever again, at least a job of any consequence. And, you know, they're now a convicted felon. And number two, because they're on probation for a long period of time, violating probation means you go to prison. So if they show up at another Occupy event, boom, off to prison they go. So this is the government's way of selectively culling out of the Occupy movement its activists and leaders. This is really evil. I mean, this is really awful stuff. Chris Hedges and I are going to be talking about this tonight on The Big Picture on an hour and 10 minutes from now on our show on Free Speech TV and RT TV. So, and perhaps we'll get him back, well, on the radio to talk about it as well. But I just wanted to make the point. You can easily track down his, he's written about this. I think it started out at Truth Dig and it got reposted over at Common Dreams and maybe Alternet or Truth Out. It's all over the place, but anyhow, it's a big deal. It's a big deal. And on the other hand, you know, the guys, the right wingers at the Clive and Bundy Ranch who showed up with guns and pointed them at federal officers, not so much has happened. Jeff in Franklin Park, Illinois. Hey, Jeff, thanks for listening to WCPT. What's up? Jeff, can you hear me? Okay, let's try Kirk in Bothell, Washington, listening on KBCS 91.3 FM. Kirk, can you hear me?
I can hear you fine, Tom. Thanks for taking the call. Thanks for always respecting the free air that we Americans are hanging onto by a shred. Sounds like, based on what you're going to talk to with Tim Hedges tonight, that the oligarchs and their minions can sense a change in the wind. And, you know, I've been listening to you talk about Tim Carpenter for the last hour, and I think it's really appropriate you're coming out to Seattle on Thursday on May Day to talk about your book. You know, Seattle's a really progressive city, and hopefully by this time next fall, you'll be able to talk about a $15 an hour minimum wage citywide on your show. And so
we had Kashama Sawant. Am I saying it right? We had your city councilor, your socialist city councilor, on this program last week talking about that.
Yeah, well, they've just begun the petition drive to collect the signature to put the initiative on the ballot, and I think the best way that folks could honor the memory of a progressive like Tim Carpenter would be on May Day to not follow the path of black bloc anarchists and have a destructive, counterproductive day of protest, but to, you know, participate in the $15 minimum wage march in Seattle or other similar positive marches that bring people in with us so that we increase our numbers and win this battle.
Yeah, I'm completely with you, Kirk. The violence and vandalism never work. I mean, you know, and I've had this debate with people over the years, but there is a power to nonviolence. It may not, it's like gravity, you know. Gravity is the weakest of the four forces, but it's the most irresistible over time. You know, gravity always wins. Nonviolence always wins. It may take a little longer, but it always wins. And you're right, honoring Tim Carpenter by becoming activists. It's a great one. Kirk, thank you for the call. Thanks for your kind words. And, yes, I will be Thursday night in Seattle, Friday night in Portland, and you can get the information over at tomhartman.com. Lynn in John Day, Oregon. Hey, Lynn, what's up?
Well, you were talking about that Democrat that voted twice. Here in Oregon, we had a lady named Dina Swenson who pleaded guilty for multiple accounts of tampering with ballots.
And what did she do?
Well, what she was indicted for originally was, unlawful altering a cast ballot, unlawfully voting more than once, and first-degree official misconduct. And she plea bargained it out. She got 90 days in jail for unlawfully altering a cast ballot.
Yeah. Did she grab somebody else's? I know that there was a case where somebody had done it for their mother in a nursing home or something like that. And
oh, she was an election worker, a registered Republican GOP election worker, working in Clackamas County as a temporary election aide, and the ballots were coming through, and, you know, you take the ballots out of the envelope. Now, she was sitting there marking them, and she got caught marking two of them. How many did she mark before they caught her?
She was a registered Republican?
Yes.
Oh, my. You know, there was a this is the debate on mail-in ballots. I lived in Oregon for 5 years, and vote by mail is very popular there. In fact, it's the only way to vote. And you have a higher, as a consequence of this, you have a higher voter participation rate. There was, and this is how they do it in the UK now, too. It's all vote by mail. And there was actually a case where in the UK there was a politician who had his machine workers basically going door to door and buying people's signed ballots. Because you signed the ballot to indicate that it's yours, you know, and you put it in an envelope and you sign the envelope as well. And people would sign the ballots and then, but unfilled out. And they would, and this guy, his people were buying them and they bought up several hundred of them to try and swing the election. It's kind of like the old machine politics, you know, the old days. Stuff like that's going to happen. Just like shoplifting happens. It doesn't mean that, you know, because shoplifting happens, you stop having stores. Or you stop allowing people to walk around in stores without wearing handcuffs. Shoplifting happens, so you enforce the laws against it. Voter fraud happens very rarely. I mean, like I said, you're more likely to die of a television falling on your head in America than to commit voter fraud. But it happens very rarely, and we have fairly draconian penalties for it. Like you pointed out, Lynn, this woman went to jail for 90 days. Thank you for the call. 90 days in jail is no small thing. Coming up tomorrow, a special edition of Brunch with Bernie. America's Senator Bernie Sanders is going to be here talking about all the important issues of the week and taking your calls, too. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It starts with you. Get out there, get active, occupy something. Check out pedamerica.org in Tim's name.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to tomhartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.